Welcome to Strat, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And I have to tell you, I wasn't sure. This was all kind of breaking as I did my last Strat podcast. And I wasn't sure if I really wanted to talk about it. But I have to tell you, this week so much has come out that I feel that I would be neglectful if I didn't bring up this issue. And the issue I want to discuss is talk about violent extremism, radicalization, and really some of the details, if you will, what happened with the Charlie Kirk assassination. And so I'm going to get into that. And I've been on the air talking about this a lot. Now, just for anyone who hasn't been watching the news or whatever, Charlie Kirk, young 31-year-old father of two, married, leader of Turning Point USA, a very conservative, politically conservative group based out of Arizona, was assassinated. Okay, and the sniper, and this was on September 10th, the sniper took a shot from a rooftop across a quad, if you will, across an open area into a place where he was doing one of his famous, tell me I'm wrong speeches, and hit him in the neck. And it looked like, and it's still waiting for more information, but it looked like it had hit the carotid artery, possibly. But once you saw the shot, if you've seen the unredacted or unedited stuff, you see a tremendous amount of blood, and you realize that that was pretty much it. There probably wasn't much they could have done. The shot was taken from about 350 meters away. It was at the Fountain Courtyard at Utah Valley University's Orem campus, and it was from a rooftop area that the sniper had got up there, got into a prone position, taken that shot. The shot was taken with a 30-aught Mauser rifle fitted with a scope. All right. Now, a couple things came out. Immediately, people were saying, well, this must have been a military trained sniper or law enforcement training or something like that because he was a sniper. Hey, look, the guy who shot at then candidate Trump in Western Pennsylvania was not a trained sniper, and he had a semi-automatic weapon. But he actually appears to have been lined up on a headshot, and President candidate Trump turned his head and he ended up nicking his ear, as opposed to what could have potentially been a fatal shot. So you don't have to be a military trained sniper to do something like this. This was about 150, 200 yards away. Very powerful round, 30-06 round, commonly used with snipers. It was a bolt action weapon, not a semi-automatic. Bolt action means that you have to physically pull the bolt back and rechamber the round in order to shoot a second round. And he had a scope, which means from that distance, he probably had extremely close, really good visibility, or depending on how you want to define that, visibility of the target, and could see quite clearly. That was some shooting that was done. The scope, with a scoped weapon properly sighted in, properly zeroed, you could be a rather mediocre marksman, and certainly at that distance, be a very effective shooter in terms of hitting whatever target you're aiming at. And so that's exactly what happened. Now, all that speculation turned out to be a waste of time. And I got to tell you, I was amongst others on the air that said, there's nothing here that indicates there's any military background. It's very possible that the shooter could have had a military background or something like that, but he didn't. All right. And it was obvious, because the shooter got away with a rifle, got away from that campus and wasn't stopped, and then was basically on the run for at least 2 days, that the security on the campus, law enforcement on the campus, was overwhelmed. They had 3,000 people at that event. Shot goes off. Everyone just took off. There was, from what I can tell, virtually no crowd management going on. And I say that because I do training of crowd managers, and there was no crowd management. Everybody just took off. And even if they were looking at where cell phones were pinging and trying to figure out where people would have been, you would have had, potentially 3,000 different cell phones all running away, all leaving the campus, all getting away. There was no attempt to give anybody, where do you go after this takes place, or try to organize them in some way that you could actually interview people for witnesses or anything else. None of that. So I think in that confusion and that lack of a managed crowd situation that he was able to successfully escape. He obviously knew the campus layout. He knew how to get onto the campus. He went to a stairwell. He went up the stairwell, jumped over, he didn't jump, but he actually climbed over a short wall to get on that roof. A lot of people have said, well, how did he have access to the roof? He didn't have access to the roof. He climbed over a wall which was denied access, and that's how he got access to the roof. And then he laid low, and at the what he considered the right time, he kind of did a crouch, walk, or run, put himself in the prone position, you know, probably, I think, a crouch walk is what I can gather, and then got clear line of sight to the target, took a shot, one shot, and then got up and did a kind of a crouch run and went to the far side of the building where he climbed over the side and then kind of jumped down to the ground and then took off and went into a residential area, and then that led to a wooded area. And I have to tell you, around that area of Utah, there's not that many really thickly wooded areas. So that is an area where to find a wooded area like that is not unusual, but it's not an area that has a lot of thickly wooded areas. And that's where he basically cached the weapon and took off. Now, they found the weapon later. There was some interesting writing on the weapon, some of it using some anti-fascist stuff. One of the phrases, interestingly enough, refers to the furry subculture. That's where people dress up in these costumes that look like furry animals, and that was kind of interesting. And there were some other things in there, too, which very much indicated someone who was completely engulfed in the online gaming-type environment, online meme environment, things like that. Not the first time we have seen lone wolf violent extremists that are tied to this online gaming or meme-centric environment. Things that you find in areas like Discord and certain, you know, subreddit in the Reddit world, stuff like that. These rather extreme things. So, obviously, that probably was where he was developing some of his ideological views, shall we say, some of his outlook on the world. And he may have been finding like-minded individuals who were leaning towards extremism or violent extremism or using violence as a means to express themselves, express their views. We will find out more about that, but that does seem to be following that pathway that we've seen so many times in the past. Obviously, he had done some research on this. There are indications he didn't know about this event that far in advance, maybe a week before it was taking place, but that's certainly more than enough time to get up there, walk around the campus, figure out what you're going to do, look at where everything would be set up, and then go on and do his shot. Now, the person that is currently under arrest and has been charged with being the assassin is a 22-year-old man named Tyler Robinson. He grew up in a conservative Southern Utah family near St. George, not in St. George, but in Washington County. But he held political beliefs that were not in alignment with his family. If you know Utah, it's a fairly conservative state. And if you know Southern Utah, it's a very conservative area in a very conservative state. So there may have been some tension with him not having political views that were aligned with his family. Now, he had earned a full ride scholarship to college, but apparently was up there about a semester and then dropped out of college and never went back, and was very much tied into the whole online world, if you will, less active in the physical world outside, more active in the online environment and gaming, and particularly games that involve guns and violence and things like Call of Duty and some other games that were really, well, I would say, combat-oriented gaming. And we've seen that before in the past as well. And there is a thought that some of these games, like Call of Duty and some others, that because of the simulation of shooting, particularly rapid-fire shooting and constantly moving and engaging targets, that mentally or emotionally, psychologically, it somewhat desensitizes those who participate in the gaming to the actual act of shooting another human being. And that's been noted time and again. Noted a lot with terrorism, that we would find that folks that were involved with terrorists, you know, folks that were ideologically aligned with ISIS or Al-Qaeda, that they would do online gaming. And it was very clear that the terrorist group saw that as a way to desensitize them to the act of doing mass killing. So that's very possible. That may be some of the psychology in play here. Now, the governor of Utah used a phrase, he called it the Reddit subculture. And Discord is also something that's been publicly, that's been reportedly aligned with the shooter as well. Look, there's all places to go. Discord was actually used primarily for gaming, as a gaming platform application, a way to get in there. And then it had all sorts of ways you could talk to people, communicate with them, video chat, all sorts of different ways to interface with others. Reddit has some features similar to that. They can interface with some social media stuff like YouTube, and there's some other features like that. And if you use third-party software, you can also, you know, make yourself transparent. In other words, they can't see that you're online. And then also you can do some certain things for anonymity purposes as well. So there are reasons why these individuals might be attracted to use this as a way to communicate themselves. Now, they have extensive chat online communications features that allow subgroups to form and of like-minded individuals. And these are folks that may be very geographically disparate. In fact, they would have never been able to meet and communicate, decades past, except now they can because they're in the same little like-minded online community and they can ramp each other up. They can radicalize their thinking. In some cases, you'll have gurus online that are grooming others to become more radical in their thinking, regardless of whatever the ideology, philosophy, whatever it is, the belief system out there. They can actually groom them to do this. And again, it's under investigation. We'll find out if maybe he had stumbled into this or found his way into something where he was maybe groomed into doing something like that. That's possible. Don't know yet. I would also point out that terrorist groups, rogue states, have used this same approach to recruit, in some case, groom terrorists, in the case of rogue states, recruit and groom those that do nefarious illegal acts on their behalf, like sabotage, assassination, things along those lines. So it's a common methodology that's out there. While we don't have the details and we don't know if that's actually what happened here, it's more likely than not that he was at least doing some sort of political, ideological interface and communications online because that's where he spent most of his time. And that would make a lot of sense. Now, another thing came out, caught me in the middle of an interview yesterday, was breaking news that he was living with someone who was a transgender man turning into a woman, and apparently they were romantically involved. And that, I mean, that actually falls into a narrative that you've heard a lot in the news. You may have seen the attack on the Catholic school by a transgender shooter there. And then, of course, a couple years before, I believe it was in Tennessee, there was another attack on a school with a transgender shooter as well. And within certain parts of the very conservative end of the political spectrum, there have been a lot of, rather strong, harsh rhetoric, if you will, aimed at the transgender community and the LGBTQ community as a whole, but particularly at the transgender community because of these high-profile shootings, one of which just happened. Charlie Kirk's organization was generally anti-immigration, anti-LGBTQ, and he had been commenting on all the things happening. What happened in Minnesota with that shooting, as I recall, was something that he had talked about as well. Charlie Kirk's organization also aims at that same age group that the shooter would fall into. So if the shooter is trying to fixate on someone that he feels is trying to villainize the transgender community, if you will, or the LGBT community on the more conservative end of the political spectrum, he may have fixated on Charlie Kirk. Obviously, to some degree, he must have because he went out there and assassinated Charlie Kirk, but that would make sense. If you were looking at this and you're trying to figure out why did he do this, some things start to fall into place that would explain what was probably going on in his mind, which means he may have had an ideological political views on the one hand, but he also has some things very, very, very much in his personal life that are tying in with that. And what we've seen with terrorists and others in the past is it's rarely just their philosophy or ideology that spurs them to do something. In some cases it is, but there's usually something, if they're a lone wolf, much closer to home. For example, there was a shooting, I believe it was in Wisconsin some years back. He was a neo-Nazi white supremacist, and he went and attacked a Sikh temple. And it was a horrific shooting of what he did. And you could look at his ideology, but then you also find out that his neo-Nazi white supremacist girlfriend had just dumped him. And so that may have been a personal trigger in his life that made him act out in this act of extreme violence. So there's probably a confluence of factors. And again, we're going to find out what was going on there as well. And so Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA fast-growing organization, a bit controversial because of its political views, and therefore that would be an explanation as to why the shooter, Robinson, focused on Charlie Kirk, and Charlie Kirk was coming to Utah. He was from southern Utah, not really that close to Orem, but he made the trip up there, obviously, in order to conduct this assassination. Now, let me get into what appears to be this confluence of factors there. More is going to surface on him as whether he was goaded into some sort of action. More will come out on his personal situation. As it is initially, his roommate and romantic partner, if you will, is cooperating with law enforcement, sharing a lot of information. It sometimes does happen that friends, family, others involved with the primary shooter or primary attacker will sometimes withhold or conceal information from federal investigators like the FBI. That is a actual chargeable offense, and we may see. And I would say you need to watch if all of a sudden his roommate lawyers up, so to speak. That tells you probably what you need to know as far as there might be more to this. It might not just be him. It might be a little bit more conspiratorial than it first appeared, and that's very, very likely. Another thing we can take from this, and kind of shifting gears from the radicalization point, the violent extremism part, is also look at the threat assessment. I'm going to say something a little controversial here. I think we do a kind of a poor job at threat assessment. I think we do that at universities poorly. I think we do it in cities poorly. I think we do it in private venues poorly, privately owned venues poorly. I just don't think we do a very good job. Very rarely do they employ, you know, threat assessment professionals that do nothing but threat assessment stuff. And sometimes if they do, they're retired law enforcement whose primary outlook is more on the enforcement side, less on the threat assessment security side. That sometimes happens, not always, but we need to do better at threat assessment, and particularly with individuals. You know, if you look at the security he had, wasn't not there. He had personal security around him, but that's a sort of personal security that keeps somebody from the crowd coming up and accosting him or physically attacking him or something like that. There was law enforcement there. I think they had a half dozen law enforcement officers from the university there. But there was a crowd of 3,000 people there. And again, they're mostly focused at the close-in threat. They're not looking at things like buildings around the area. They're not thinking about things like snipers. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is not the first sniper incident we've had. We've had other sniper incidents. I mentioned we had two just this last year. One that took shots and one was prepared to take shots against Donald Trump. And that was during the election. If you go back to Route 91 concert in Las Vegas, that was a sniper that set up a rather extensive sniper's nest in a suite in Mandalay Bay Hotel and then just fired what was effectively almost automatic gunfire into the concert venue itself, causing horrendous injuries and death at that place. But I do recall going up to Las Vegas right after that, talking to someone who was very much involved with the security of that venue. And we talked about sniper threats for a little bit and counter sniper stuff. And then we immediately started talking about drones and drones as threats and drones as probably the next area that we need to look at. There's another side too. If you're looking at snipers, you look at drones as a way to expand your perimeter. And you could put drones out there for surveillance. That would have probably been invaluable if they had had a drone flying around looking at all the buildings, looking at windows, looking at possible open windows. Used in a counter sniper role, that would have been a very efficient, effective use of manpower and technology in order to perform that role. Maybe a little noisy because there would have been a drone flying around. The other thing is a drone can actually intercept another drone. So if someone was to use a drone as a vector of attack and you had a drone out there as for surveillance or whatever, if need be, you can actually use that drone to intercept the other drone kinetically. And that's one thing that can be done as possible. The other thing is sometimes drones can be affixed with, well, obviously lethal means, but whether it's explosives or a weapon of some sort, a gun, whatever, but also non-lethal. And it could be stuff that blinds a potential attacker with a bright light using sound, very acoustic methodologies with that, or technologies, I should say, with that. And then I've even seen them equipped where they can use some sort of caustic chemical thing like pepper spray, or you could actually rig them up with a pepper spray gun if you wanted. against a potential attacker. And what this does is it buys you time, it disrupts your attack, it may dissuade them from carrying out the attack. And so there's a lot of different things that we know with drones, and I think we need to probably look at drones for this. The other thing was talked about, and you saw this, was Donald Trump, when he was a candidate, he loved to go out there and everybody could just see him. And obviously, that didn't work so well in Butler, Pennsylvania. And after that, what you see is when he speaks, he'll have ballistic glass up around him to prevent or basically deter somebody from trying to do a sniper shot. Ballistic glass is going to, you know, it's not going to protect against every type of sniper weapon, but it does provide a higher degree of assurance that certain weapons will not be effective. And if someone does that, it will reduce the ballistic trajectory, the power of the round, simply by hitting it, even if the round was managed to penetrate it, making it a little less lethal, if you will. And it also might, make it more difficult to target the person that the sniper is looking at, and that can buy time to get the person out of line of sight. So there's a lot of reasons why you might see that. So I think you're going to see those two methodologies looked at very, very closely for things that you wouldn't normally think about. All right. So, and finally, the last thing I want to say is I've been since the early 90s, since the internet began, I've been working with federal, state, local law enforcement at looking at the internet and looking at criminal activity, illegal activity tied to the internet all these many years in all of its different forms. When social media first started being used, all this stuff, I've been looking at this across the board, and gaming things and platforms. We've got to get a little more serious about this. Yes, we have internet sleuths, if you will. We have internet crime, internet criminal investigations, internet forensic computer things that are done. That's a really dated term, by the way. But we've never really settled down to comprehensively figure out who has jurisdiction for patrolling the internet. Who has jurisdiction for going out there and proactively looking for these like-minded individuals and trying to intercept this stuff? You know, the FBI does a lot. And I will tell you, there have been a number of cases where it's very clear that it was, they probably were using the internet and doing something online where they found these individuals, and they do some very effective stuff. But I do think that we need to step this up a little bit further, because we're missing some of these lone wolves. In fact, we're missing a number of these lone wolves. And I'm going to go back to that saying I've been saying for decades, which is, before they're acting out in the real world, they're usually venting like crazy in the virtual world. And that may be the case here, but we need to pick up on that venting and then take proactive action to stop it from becoming an act of violent extremism, whatever the motivation. And we need to figure out who's ultimately responsible. The FBI's got it, but then DHS has some of it, and then state locals have another piece of it. Open source intelligence is a huge area, but there's also open source counterintelligence that goes on. And we need to kind of take a look at this and figure out jurisdictionally who's got the lead and putting more resources into that arena. Thanks for listening to Strat. Please visit stratpodcast.com. You can go to my YouTube channel, How Comfort TV. You can go to my corporate website, www.gripsa, GRIP for Global Risk Intelligence Planning, GRIPSA, gripsa.com. And hopefully you'll tune into the next one. And I really hope that you found something valuable from this one.